time to listen to the interviews from Iron Life on Saturday the 18th of May 2013. Iron Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua. On Saturday the 18th of May, Jan Scott talked to Catherine Napo about the Matiatia Matters public meeting, Bill Carrick from the Waiheke Hospice Trust, and houseboat resident Mikey Nucky.
And now it's my pleasure to say good morning to Catherine Napo. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Jen.
I'm glad you could make it in to give us an update on the meeting tomorrow. Now, just a little bit of background with you. You've been on the island all your life, haven't you?
Yep. I was born in 1960, I hate to admit. And I've lived away, you know, how you go away for a few years here and there. I've done that. But basically, most of my life has been on the island and unfortunately in the same road as my mother. I mean, not that I mind living, I love living in the same road as her, but I haven't moved very far from home.
Oh, that's great. Mm. Yeah. So your interest in Waiheke is inbred, as it were.
Yep, it's in the blood. It's in the heart, I'd say.
Right. Yep. I must admit, I haven't seen your name a lot, and therefore that sort of says to me that you're not one of the usual protagonists that are anti-everything. Is that right?
You could sort of say that. I picked my battles over the years. So a long time ago, in the early 80s, I was heavily involved in the peace group. And then I was a place centre mother for 10 years. And that's not so much picking your battles, but it's, you know, giving all of your time to one particular thing. And I was adult literacy, Waiheke Credit Union, those sort of community things. And also, a few years ago, they closed the outpost of Auckland Sexual Abuse Help, and I was involved in that as well. So there's various things which I choose to be involved in, you know, because you have to get the energy together to do it. And I guess this Matete thing is one of them.
Right. And, of course, you spoke with Sharon last week on Island Life about the reasons for calling this public meeting. Mm. And basically, if we just recap on that so that people who may not have heard last week's interview will have an idea why you've called this meeting.
Well, I guess if you were looking at sort of the thing which pushes you into action, it would have been the marina. But it's not all about the marina. So the marina made me think, and then I thought, okay, we need a public meeting. I didn't do this alone. I'm part of a group called Essentially Waiheke. And I sort of did it. I took it upon myself to do it. But that group is also in the background there.
What's the update for the meeting tomorrow? You've got the program all.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it wasn't just about the marina. It was also, there were two issues. There was the marina and the parking. Both things had really got people going recently. And what it made me think was, I was upset about both of those things. But what upset me the most was that really Matetia is such an incredibly important bay on the island. It's probably the most important place on the island in terms of our daily life. And there is no plan, a plan which is big, which is at a local body level, at an Auckland City level and at a Waiheke board level. There should be a plan in place, which means that you can't just have a marina, you can't just do this, you can't just do that, because there should be some sort of needs prioritised, there should be existing uses prioritised, and that should be already there. So a person can't just say, oh, I want to do something, and have that considered separately to everything else.
This issue came up 8 years, I think, ago when Auckland City bought the area where the restaurant is now, and was going to put a little village and things like that. Yep. And they said back then that they were going to come up with this overall Matiatia plan.
Yep.
So it's been talked about for goodness knows how long, but nothing happens.
Well, I wonder, I think that there were some documents prepared, but I don't think they were prepared, put into action and consistently adhered to. You know, I think they languished at the side, and then that's pretty much gone, perhaps, because it certainly doesn't appear to be in place now.
No, that's for sure. Yeah. And, you know, to my knowledge, for the transport thing, for instance, with the car parking, they said they wanted an overall transport plan for Maitiati before they decided what they were going to do with the car parking. And nothing happened with that. It's languished. So it's very frustrating.
Right. It is. And the other thing is that when they prepare the plans, I think, and if a plan was prepared now, it requires less public consultation than it ever has before, simply because of the way the super city has been formed. You can sort of rubber stamp public consultation now. So instead of it going from the grassroots up, it comes from the top down. And then it doesn't really address what people need because they haven't listened properly.
No, you're right. And that's a real concern with the unitary plan. Is the, you know, when I came on Al and Simon's show and we had a quick chat, that Auckland City's got this one-size-fits-all mentality. And all of the unitary plan doesn't take into account the differences of the little areas within Auckland City.
That's
and, of
right.
course, Waiheke is a prime example of that because it is so unique. And we really don't want to be one-size-fits-all with the rest of the city.
No, and I don't think it's to Auckland City's advantage either because the uniqueness here is obviously part of the attraction. That's why millions of people are coming here each year. And if you go in, you make it look just like everywhere else. If you apply the same rules as everywhere else, it isn't going to work. It's not going to be advantageous for us or for them.
Right. So what is your hope for tomorrow's meeting?
Tomorrow's meeting was planned purely as an awareness-raising meeting. And so I was hoping that if people came, they would hear various sides to the story. So you're going to be speaking at the meeting about parking. Jim Hannon's also going to be speaking about parking and the transport down at Maitiati. Huhana Davis-Ryan is coming from the Marae to speak from a Marae perspective, as is Paula Te Rangiwaia, the sculptor Paula. And then Daniel Breen's going to be speaking from an ecological perspective. I think that will probably be more honed in on the marina sort of side of things, perhaps, or at least on the ecology of the bay. And Brian Griffiths is going to be there from Forest and Bird, and he's going to sort of take more of a planning perspective, I think. So that's the speakers tomorrow. And the idea is that people will come, they will listen to the speakers, there'll be time to question the speakers, and then after that there'll be a public forum. Each speaker's supposed to have 7 minutes, and I'm going to hopefully have 7 minutes at the beginning just to introduce it and to set the scene. I'm not an expert, so it's a local initiative as far as I'm concerned. It's local speakers, and it's people who aren't experts, you know, because you don't have to be an expert to take action or to speak out about something. So I guess that's where I'm coming from.
Right, and I should explain that I'll be speaking with my ferry users group hat on. I'm currently chair of that group. Now, of course, since you've called this meeting, the idea of putting the marina at Kennedy Point's been raised, and that's an interesting thing to throw into the mix.
That's right, and I, that was walking up the road today and someone stopped me and said, what do you think of the marina at Kennedy Point? And I think from my point of view, you can't say whether that's a good thing or a bad thing without actually seeing a plan which said exactly what would happen there. But I think from the point of view of getting it out of Maitiati, that's a good idea. I mean, I would always worry because I know that all of the schools and the play schools are located on that road. You know, there's like, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 even educational places on that road. So you'd always have to be careful about parking and, you know, the increase in traffic at different times. But it certainly, from most points of view, would take the pressure off Maitiati a bit. And when you think about Maitiati, it's a lot of things to a lot of people. But in reality, it is so many hectares of sea and land. And how you use that most important sort of bit of Waiheke is a really important thing for our future.
What are you hoping the outcome of the meeting tomorrow will be?
I would hope that, I know I've invited all of the council to come just as members of the audience. I'd hope that they'd listen, that when I say the council, I don't mean the council, I mean the board. I hope that they'd listen and maybe get a few more ideas. You never know what ideas will crop up at a public meeting, like so for the parking. You know, maybe something would, maybe some sort of proposal could come out of the meeting about the parking. maybe some really good ideas for future action. I know that I was reading in the Gulf News this week that the council or the board would have tried to do something about the upper car park, but there's been a transfer of rights over it to Watercare, and so therefore that's made it hard for them. Maybe something could come out of the meeting regarding that upper car park, because people have been saying to me, you could fit more car parks in there, you could make it safer for people to walk on to, you know, to access, because the path is really lousy. So maybe some small ideas could come out which could improve things immediately, or maybe proposed off-site, you know, park and ride sites could be talked about. I don't know. So different ideas could come up about the parking, I'm thinking. There could also be people who might like to put their name down on a contacts list, you know, regarding the parking, who might have something to offer later, and maybe get together and form a new parking group, I don't know, or add to the groups that you've already got going about that issue. The same for the marina sort of proposal. I think it would be good to get a list of people who might like to, from my point of view anyway, because I don't approve of the marina being there, who might like to come along to a later meeting to write submissions, or who might want to know how to write submissions, who might want to be updated on future information and stuff like that. So a list of names for both things, and perhaps some sort of proposal to put forward to board about a way forward.
Right. The submission process, I think that closes at the end of this month.
Well, I don't know that they've notified it yet.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you can't write a submission until they actually put the document out as notified. It's been lodged. I don't know. I might be behind the times. Maybe it has come out that it's been notified. But I know that it's been lodged, but not notified for public submissions.
Right. I'm probably thinking of the unitary plan. And it would be just as important to put in a submission about Mātētea in that in relation to the unitary plan.
That's probably a good idea. Although Christopher Ragg reckons you have to know what you're talking about to do that.
Well, I mean, you do. Yeah. And he's got an amazing knowledge of how to do that. And I think last week you were on the radio at the same time as Christopher, weren't you? And was hoping that he might bring along a pro forma submission that people could just
That would be good.
Send in. And that was fairly fairly straightforward and not as technical. It wouldn't have to be as technical.
No.
But
I think sometimes the content counts and sometimes the numbers count. And I think you can't tell which of those times it will be. I know that when Graham Guthrie was talking about his marina plan, he said that there were 250-something submissions for and only 50 submissions against. And, you know, that numbers thing sort of, it doesn't necessarily mean content, but it does, probably not a good thing. You know, you do want your numbers to be up, probably. I actually don't know how submissions work. I've never, ever made one, so this is going to be my first submission. I mean, other than one of those little forms that you fill in.
Right. Yeah. From my understanding, the numbers do count.
Mm.
And a lot of people don't think about putting in a submission in support of something. They put in a submission against something.
Mm.
So if you really like something, you assume, oh, well, I don't need to put in a submission because of that. So I guess you could make a submission to say that you like Mātētea the way it is and want to leave it that way. They also, I know from experience that the council doesn't listen to emotional rhetoric. They want something that's clear and concise and factually based.
Mm.
So that, I don't know if that's helpful or not, but hopefully Christopher will be there with a pro forma that people can use, or at least, you know, have.
Well, what I was hoping was that we would have another meeting, which, not necessarily in the Ostend Hall, but somewhere else where we could help people like me learn how to fill in a submission, or even just have a form there that they could fill in. But as yet, because it's not notified, it's not really the time to do that.
Right. We're talking to Catherine Napo about the Mātētea Matters public meeting that will be held tomorrow between 10:30 and 12:30 at the Ostend Hall. Catherine, the program, you've got seven or eight speakers, did you say?
There are six invited speakers, and I'll also introduce it. So I'm just going to be an introductory, right, introducing people to the day.
And each of those speakers will be talking on something different relating to Ngātiatia, yep, and then it'll be open to the public floor, I presume.
Yeah.
Right.
It's open for questions first to the speakers, and then for people to just stand up and have their say. There's no intent that, you know, everyone will be against this or against that. It's just a place to air a public view.
Information and a personal
sharing. View. Yeah, information sharing entirely.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. Well, let's hope that as many people as possible come along and share their views. So
yeah, that would be
particularly
great.
Particularly if the local board are going to be there in force and they can hear how the people feel about these things.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I've been on a little stall at the market, and it's called a listening station, and it's really amazing what people say if you're there listening. You know, you hear about all sorts of different views about different things, and you think, wow, I would have never known that. So yeah, please come, everybody.
Okay, well, we wish you luck with the meeting tomorrow, Catherine.
Thank you.
And if you can make it along to the Ngātiatia Matters meeting tomorrow afternoon at the tomorrow morning, 10:30 to 12:30 at the Ostend Hall, that would be great.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in, Catherine.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
And now it's my pleasure to welcome Bill Carrig. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Jan. How are you this morning?
I'm very well, thank you.
A bit of a wet start for the day.
It was indeed, but hey, it's not looking too bad out there now.
No, it's quite warm, and at least we didn't have to catch a ferry this morning.
Exactly. Now, Bill, you're chair of the Hospice Committee.
Yes, Waiheke Home Care Hospice is our official title, and we reside at Wharf Road in a little building called Estuary Cottage.
Right, and that's something that the Hospice Committee fundraised for and bought, isn't it?
Yeah, not so much the committee. I guess it was really friends of Hospice, led by Vernon Betsy Whitehead, Denise and Ross Goodwin, myself, and Antoinette. So it was 10 years, plus Denise and I and Antoinette and Ross did another year with a gap, and yeah, we raised close on, I think, over $750,000 in that period, which was a fantastic amount.
And that was through the famous garden party, wasn't it?
Yeah, the annual garden party. I remember the first one that was held down in Onuraa at the Andersons' household. I remember saying to Vern, I think you might have a tiger by the tail here, chap. And that's exactly what it was. It was the all-encompassing party. Unfortunately, it's been a little hijacked today. And so we move on to other things to fundraise for our hospice.
Well, I recall when the hospice started, or the committee started, that they used to fundraise with things like a debate at the Ostend Hall, and Chris Reeve would be on one side and somebody else would be on the other, because I think he was one of the ones that started up the committee or the fundraising for cancer awareness.
Yeah, it was really, Chris was part of it, and I think Vonnie McGuire, who resides up Northland Way these days, along with Katrina Foster, of course, our long and valued serving district health nurse, they started that off. And of course, there was that great orator that's still with us, fortunately, Martin Green, was always on the opposing side, and Martin was always some source of very much great amusement, and added a certain alacrity to the discussion. So he was superb.
Yes, they were fun events, that's for sure.
Yeah, but all these events take a lot of time and energy. That's why I guess the garden party was so popular. It was one big hit, and in the end, the last one that the three groups put together, I think we had two meetings, and they happened to be on the ferry going to work. We all knew our tasks, we all knew our jobs, and it was great. And there were some really generous people who opened up their homes to host the event. And they shouldn't go unnoticed. They were very generous. And there's too many to mention, but they know, everybody knows who they are.
Mm. Indeed. The problem with this sort of fundraising is that it falls to the same small group all the time, doesn't it? And the committee or the group gets tired, gets worn out, and there's nobody coming through to help take over.
Well, there's that wonderful saying, if you want something done, give it to a busy person. And we all held full-time jobs, and still do, most of us. And that's very much, it denied us a lot of our Christmas vacation, because it was the first Saturday in the new year. That was designed for a reason, to get all those people that wanted to be, as we called them, wannabe Waihikians, to enjoy the mixture. And it was a catch up of people used to get to see one another. And then, of course, the GFC came along and things got a little bit tougher. People weren't so open with their wallets. But no, fundraising is still an important part and will continue to be an important part, and hospice has a few initiatives in place. I think it's probably important at this point to just acknowledge the fantastic job that Sue Biggs did during the this week in coordinating the volunteers to raise, through shaking the bucket in front of ferry users, people in Onirua Village, and down at the supermarket. She collected, with her team of volunteers, just under $4,000. That's a fantastic effort. Mm. Given that, tough times out there for a lot of people that live on the island. And there's always, it never ceases to amaze me, the generosity of Waihikians in putting their hand into their pocket and going without for some legitimate cause.
Mm, that's absolutely right. You're listening to Waiheke Radio, the Waiheke's community radio station, and we're talking to Bill Carrig, who's the chair of the Waiheke Hospice Committee. I was surprised, Bill, that the fundraising this week was quite low-key. And, in fact, the only place I came across it was at the wharf, and got chatting to the two women there, and they said how generous people had been just by doing that. And in some ways, I think that approach was probably to your advantage, because people get a bit tired of having buckets shoved under their noses every few yards up the road.
Well, Sue kindly volunteered to take it on at very much a last minute, and she shifted house and done a whole bunch of other things. And so she, in a very short time, pulled it all together. The neat thing about this collection is what we collect actually physically stays on the island, not like a lot of other collections that are taken on the island, are actually taken off the island, and then we get a divvy up as to what ultimately is collected. So people can be rest assured that the money that was collected here stays here and goes into the services that hospice provide in the day-stay situation.
That's an important point. What services does hospice provide on the island?
Well, people, naturally enough, hospice means end of life, and it's that journey that everybody undertakes. And the hospice here isn't a in bed situation like perhaps Mercy or North Shore or North Haven up in Whangarei or any of the other hospices. Ours is a homestay, and last year, We cared for 22 patients, which allows people to end their life gracefully and with respect and dignity at home, surrounded by their loved ones. We also assist with things like going into Auckland to receive treatment, either radiotherapy or chemotherapy. And that's in the form of a taxi chit to go down to the ferry and getting a taxi at the other end. From my own personal experience, it's very difficult. Someone has to be left on the wharf while you go and park the car, and then at the other end you have to get a car or a bus or public transport. And this alleviates all that stress, because it is a stressful time while people are undergoing chemotherapy or radiotherapy. And it's just to smooth the path that it takes. One of the other attributes that we use the money for is to put some domestic assistance in the homes. I always jokingly say to my fellow trustees quite often, if someone's diagnosed with cancer and they're under the age of 65, the best thing they could do is go out and ride a motorbike or take a horse ride and fall off it, and then you'll be covered by ACC. Unfortunately, if you're perhaps a two-person working home and one undergoes, one has to receive some treatment, there's no financial or home help in that situation. So we have, through the Health Trust, we contract the Health Trust and we fund them separately. So the money goes to that area to support those functions.
So the funding that the hospice gets is mainly through fundraising, or do you have sponsorship or public government funding for anything?
Because we're a home care hospice, we receive no government funding whatsoever. So it's we're at the beck of the community. We do get, from time to time, we apply for a number of sponsorships, if you like, or grants that are available out there. Some were successful, but most of the time we've got to put it towards a project. Our manager, Mags McLeod, she spends anywhere between 20 to 30 hours a week on average administering. She also does grief counselling, and that's a fairly sizable chunk of her time being a qualified grief counsellor. So she can take people through that post-death journey of their loved ones.
Right. What services do you provide at the house?
It's a very much a meeting point where people can come in. If people do want respite, if a caregiver wants a bit of a break away, we can provide that. And then in that case, we can put a nurse in for the night. And it just means someone can get a decent night's sleep without the disturbance, because it's a 24/7 when people are needing to be cared, and some people just need a break away. We have reviewed the use of the house, and we're participating in the discussions on the integrated health centre, and I think that's where the future direction of hospice will become part of the integrated health centre, where we will have our facilities in there, which means that we at some stage in the future may be considering liquidating the hospice house, and that will give us, it gives us a better utilisation of that facility. The doctors meet once a month, and there's a video conferencing comes in, and there's an educational, and the facility is used for that. And of course, it's used for meetings related to cancer or to hospice.
So it wasn't intended to be a residential house?
No, it was never done that. The cost of compliance in today's world, even though it's highly specced in terms of its showering facilities, its bathroom facilities, its layout, the hospital beds, it was never designed that we would care for a patient there. The cost of compliance is just too high in that respect.
Right. I know a few years ago that the cost of somebody in a hospital bed was a lot more expensive than caring for them in their own home. Is that still the case?
Still very much the case. And that's where, if I can speak on the subject of the integrated health centre, that's one of the reasons why I think the government is trying to initiate things that where it's more community-based rather than centralised. And we see some huge advantages that we could hold somebody here overnight with the attached services, rather than choppering them off the island and finding that they're held in Auckland for observation for 24 hours at a huge cost at a central hospital facility.
That sounds brilliant, because that was one of the original intentions of the Health Trust when it was set up, to
absolutely
to have help in the home overnight, put a nurse in for the evening or something of that sort, and that never quite happened because they didn't get the funding.
Yes.
The hope was that we would get the dollar value per person for Waiheke to use for that health reasons on the island?
I think the Health Trust punches way above its weight in terms of what it's funded, and it's clearly outgrown its facility. As an employer, we all have an obligation to ensure that you have the best facilities for the staff, best equipment, and I think that's what, if we're to move forward and take it through to the next 20 years, and we can do it on a cost-effective basis, and that's the key, cost-effective, that's where the future lies.
Yes, exactly. Mind you, that facility was a good jumping block, if you like, or starting block. And it took quite a bit of persuasion to get that land and build the facility. I think it was St John Ambulance that owned, or they owned houses on the island, and they were persuaded to sell the houses and the old ambulance station in Moa Ave and buy that section next to the medical centre to build a new station in the Health Trust rooms. Part of that was sort of added on, but it was a great initiative back then, and hopefully it will provide for an even greater facility in the future.
Sure.
So, Bill, what is the future? I guess that this integrated system is really what you're working on at the moment.
Well, yeah, but it's like everything. It's like everything we do on Waiheke. It's never plain sailing. I mean, say the tide changes, the wind shifts, and so one's got to beat into the wind. We're running away with the wind, and so it's always a challenge. And there's people who it's easy to be negative than positive, and. It's taken a slow change, but because by the very nature, people aren't as human beings, we're not good at justice to change. But in the meantime, hospice will maintain in its current facility. Megs and her team and Katrina will continue to attend to those who need the services in any shape, way, or form. And there's things that they're doing that people don't realise is people want a massage because that seems to be a very accepted way of therapeutic, making them feel better. They do that as well as part of all the ongoing care. And it's that ongoing care. I mean, say hospice, anybody who's been through a hospice facility or service, had a relative or friend, always speak very, very highly of it. We've got a situation where there's the great bed race and out west, and there's a relative who received our care a number of years ago. This team of guys in Auckland are entering, and the proceeds from there are going towards our hospice. So it's you just never know where your funding goes. A lot of time people leave the island after receiving initial care from us, but they want to be in a bed situation, be it Mercy or North Shore or some other hospice. And inevitably, if they pass away in that facility, well, they're the last one. They're the one that most vivid, and they receive the benefit of any money. And that's just life. You can't do a lot about that. That's just straight out life. And I know I've sat around many a meeting where the North Shore people are a bit perturbed because a North Shore resident has wanted to be in Mercy, and all the money has gone in that direction. So, but hospices generally have an improved funding these days. The government, the last budget 3 years ago now, I believe, they did fund them considerably more. So instead of it being in the order of 35 from the government, it's almost moved to a 50-50 scenario. Some are better than others. Some are more organised. I've got friends that have worked in Mary Potter, worked in North Haven, and now work in Timowanga. I hear the people from Mercy, and it's a constant battle to fundraise, because running healthcare is an expensive business.
Absolutely.
And New Zealand generally punches above its weight in terms of compared to Australia and America.
That's good to know. Now, with regard to your committee, do you have people willing to serve, or have you still got the same people who are doing the hard work and maybe wanting a break?
It's not exactly a high churn. It's one of those things that people are there because they want to be there. It's their contribution. And there's five trustees, Mark Graydon, Susie Flegg, Katrina Foster, myself, and I'm just missing one other. Oh, Gillie O'Neill. Gillie O'Neill. Sorry, Gillie.
So that's your committee, as it were.
That's our trustees. We have Brenda Beekhoff as our secretary, and then we have Mags McLeod, who's our manager. Mm-hmm. And we meet every alternative month. Endeavour to. Sometimes we get held up. Not everybody's available, but it's really all about governance, and people can be rest assured that no one, when we have our trustee meetings, there's consummate patient confidentiality. I have no idea, absolutely no idea, as to who is being who's being cared for, and that, because that's not our business. Our business is governance, to ensure the money and the compliance is all in order. We're not about the trustees aren't about physically looking after the patients.
Right. So, how was the health trust set up?
The hospice or the health trust?
Oh, sorry, the hospice.
Well, it's under a charitable trust. It's got a deed of trustee. And it just works that we have an annual general meeting, public notification. Like a lot of organisations, it doesn't have a high attendance from the public. Always welcome that. Always welcome scrutiny. And where all the accounts are put forward, auditors' reports, just the normal compliance.
Do you come under the umbrella of a national hospice body?
Well, we are members, but we're really affiliate members because we're not a full-blown hospice. We don't we have no voting rights. I attend occasionally Hospices of Auckland meetings, and to get involved, but we really have no say. It's for FYI, really, for your information only. Mags and Katrina being the Foster being the key palliative care nurse, she and Mags attend various conferences, but the rest of the trustees know. That's important that they maintain that contact through their, particularly relative to volunteers. And I'd just like to bring up the point on volunteers. We have an enormous pool of volunteers. Sometimes it tops 30, sometimes it gets as low as 24, but there's a wonderful group of people that are prepared to put their time and effort into doing things on the island, and that's just fabulous.
Absolutely. And what sort of work would the volunteers do apart from fundraising?
Minimal fundraising. Most of it is really patient support, just patient support. Might be driving somebody somewhere. It might be during the day. It could be doing a simple task. It could be just going in and reading a book, just being there as a companion, because there are a lot of single occupancies on the island. And so It's a bit of an effort for someone to come over from town, and some people's families are moved away. Some people don't have any families to look after them. So it's that's really the function of that, and that's all coordinated by Mags.
Do your volunteers need any training?
Mags puts them through a training program, yes.
Right. Yeah. So if anybody's interested in becoming a volunteer, they would contact the Mags at the hospice.
Absolutely.
Which
absolutely.
Is in the local phone book, I presume.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right at the front.
Right at the front. Okay.
Yeah.
As you are right at the front of the health system on the island, really.
Totally.
Yeah.
All part of that end of stage life journey.
Yes. Yeah. An interesting one that we all have to do. Yeah.
Some sooner than later.
Yeah, that's right. Let's hope it's later.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in, Bill. We've been talking to Bill Carey, the chair of the Waiheke Hospice Trust.
Thanks very much for having me in here, Jan.
A pleasure.
Cheers.
Waiheke Radio.
Yes, you're listening to Island Life. I'm Jan Scott, and Island Life is on Waiheke Radio, of course, your community radio station. And we're just about to welcome Mikey Nucky. Is that right?
That's right.
That's right. We've got that one there. And, sorry, your name?
Vera.
And Vera, right. And they're from the houseboats at Rangahau. Is that correct? Just hang on a minute. We'll put you on. Okay. Now I think we've got contact. Right. So if you bring that as close to you as you can, or perhaps use the same one. I'm not sure if that one's working.
Okay. We'll do that.
Great. Yes. Yeah, sorry about that. Well, thank you both for coming in. Mm. Now, tell me something about the issue with the houseboats. I gather that the whole thing's come up through the unitary plan, and that there's no provision for houseboats in that plan. Is that correct?
In some respects, yes. Depends on which part of the plan you look at, but it seems that our consultations with planners and things, as we've been trying to get behind the scenes and see what it all means, that we're possibly going to be allowed to stay.
Ooh.
We're going to
vie for that.
Absolutely.
Lobby for that, yes.
Yeah. And I noticed from the article in the Gulf New, or the Marketplace, I think it was, that the houseboat owners are quite happy to pay a fee or something of that sort of like rates,
totally.
For the rights to stay there. And
yes.
I think that has been something that people have muttered about in the past. Why should these people get away without paying rates and that sort of thing? And that is great. That you're addressing that side of things.
Yes, well, we had a chance 15 years ago to have a resource consent, but we're all a little bit individual in that we like our sort of space and solitude and our own way of doing things. And offering us a joint application, as they did then, sort of made it really hard for us to come to a unanimous decision, and some of the others wanted to contest the fact that we even needed a resource consent and existing use rights. And that's the ARC, as it was then, sort of accepted that, which to my surprise, and nothing ever happened. I was all for getting a resource consent then, because it would probably lead to some form of surety of mooring tenure. And
Exactly. So you're hopeful now that that will happen?
Oh, yes, very.
Yes, definitely.
Yes.
Are you making submissions? Or?
Oh, yes.
Right.
Yeah, we've been working very hard for the last couple of weeks, meeting together as a group and coming up with, you know, ideas and submissions, and including a joint submission and probably some personal ones as well, from a personal point of view, from the houseboat people that live there.
Well, it would also be good to get submissions from your average Waihekian in support, because
oh, yes,
there are an awful
yes,
lot of people out there who would hate to see them go.
Yes, we've become an icon over the years,
yes.
And it definitely would be a sad loss to both Waiheke in terms of, you know, the residents and citizens that live here, and also in terms of tourism and many other issues. It would be a huge loss.
Mm, absolutely. So what drew you to living on a houseboat?
I was wondering if you'd talk about that. It's not an easy thing to do. I gradually arrived at it slowly. First of all, I lived in a boat shed in Cox's Bay, and that's I love being around the water. And then lived on an old Devonport ferry that may have probably come down here as well in the old days, the Tauroa.
Oh, right.
And that was a magical. They were floating there at in the corner of the viaduct.
Mm. That's
harbour by the tank farm. And
whatever happened to that boat?
It is now up on the land by the Northwestern Motorway, the Lincoln Road interchange.
Oh, what an unfortunate spot.
The poor old Tora is quite a sad case as far as ferries go, because the Kestrel is still floating, and the Kestrel was built entirely of timber, whereas the Tora was a later one, 1928, I think, and they used steel ribs, and steel and timber don't go together in a marine environment. The steel rots. The steel rusts, and it affects the timber. It's called delignification.
Oh, right.
And it causes it to lose its strength.
Right. Well, that's sad, yeah.
And, of course, the frames have all rusted away, and it's a major, major restoration job if they're going to succeed.
I bet it will be. So how did you come to Waiheke Houseboats?
I started off my... renting the wool shed when it was a wool shed as a workshop. And while I was there, a friend wanted to get rid of a batch. It happened to be across the bay at Anzac Bay. And I was going to try and move the batch, slide it down the bank to the beach and put it on drums and take it across to the where the houseboats are and moor it there. Proved to be a bit difficult, so I took it apart and rebuilt it as a houseboat.
Oh, okay. Brilliant.
For me, I've actually lived on and off Waiheke for my whole life, so ever since I was 7, I came here in the late 80s with my family, and at the time my father had actually purchased a house and land and decided that he had some friends on some of the houseboats and decided that he would like, you know, to live a really low-impact lifestyle that's environmentally friendly and, you know, in harmony with nature. And so he sold up his house and moved onto a houseboat as, you know, his choice of how he wanted to live. And I've basically grown up on the houseboats my whole life. I recently decided, you know, that I would want to live on Waiheke full time. I came back from Australia and before the birth of my daughter, and just wanted to live a simple lifestyle on a houseboat, particularly because I had, you know, experienced and lived this lifestyle for my whole life, and wanting to also be able to offer that opportunity to my daughter, you know, to live a lifestyle that she chooses, you know, in harmony with nature, loving nature, looking after nature. Originally I came here and was offered a piece of land, and at the time the owner builder restrictions came in, so I wasn't able to build a house in an ecologically sound way, in the way that I wanted to do it. Then I recently made, you know, the firm decision to be on Waiheke, to live on Waiheke full time and live on a houseboat, and came back in from Australia from a family visit, and found that the unitary plan was the next thing that was going to be some kind of restriction on, you know, freedom of choice and rights. So that's been really hard.
I think the submissions for the unitary plan close at the end of this month, don't they?
Yes, 31st. 5 p.m.
Right. Okay. So how have you been getting people to submit? Have you?
We have been meeting with the wider boating community of Putiki Bay. Right. With Bernard and Ursula from... Ursula lives on Sunflower, and she's very proactive and engaged in the process of research, and which we've been researching everything from history, houseboat history throughout the world, and because it's all going to go into our submission. Just freedom to choose where one would like to live, you know, surely... And things like that may be more to do with our particular situation up the Rangihua Creek.
Right. I went on the website that somebody started up on this whole issue.
That's Ursula's, yes.
Right.
What's it called? Waiheke Houseboat or something,
something like that. I can't remember, but it's excellent. It's a blog spot. Because it reminded me, I hadn't twigged to the houseboats in London, for instance. You'd see there's boats on the side of the river, and it hadn't occurred to me that they were houseboats. Same with the ones you know in Paris, and I suppose because they look a bit different to the ones we have, but. They've got the mix right there, where they're allowing people to live on boats and in a far more built-up area. And I don't know how ecological those houseboats are, but certainly the ones on Waiheke.
I think the ones in London and the canals are connected to the land, you know, for power and water and sewage, probably.
The council provides services.
And if you go on Google, if you go on Google Earth and look around London, you can... spy quite a few interesting I've done that.
Okay. Now I guess that's a concern that some people have about the houseboats on Waiheke is the facilities and whether how much of the sewage and waste is going into the harbour.
Yes, well, we have been experimenting with like composting toilets and that sort of thing, and I think we could, now that my latest model is pretty odour-free, that we could have them on board.
Right.
And to do with this unitary plan and getting a resource consent, I've been considering that we should have a little garden on board as well.
All right.
I thought about this years ago, but haven't done anything about it.
I think that we also we minimise our impact on the environment. So all our water that we use is recycled onto gardens, either our own gardens or friends' gardens. We actually do not dispense any materials into the Rangihaua Creek.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's so important to us, just like it is to the rest of the community. It's such a huge concern for us on the houseboats.
Right. So you have a holding tank, do you?
Some people do. I think the boats in Putiki Bay definitely do. I tend to catch it in a type of tank and then put it out onto the garden on a regular basis.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Do you have access to the facilities at the dirt track?
No.
No. No, because I think...
They're a little bit...
Some people sort of thought you were using the showers and things there, but...
We go to the sports park
sports
when
park
water
and friends
gets...
friends' houses.
And
of course the,
we
you
do
know,
our washing
bummer,
at friends' houses.
Yeah.
We don't have enough water for our washing. We don't store enough. And when water gets low, like a lot of people, we go to the sports park for showers.
Yes, a few people have been doing that.
Yes, we even ran dry.
So what are the... You probably mentioned some of them, but the hardships or the difficulties of living on a houseboat...
Yes, they are plenty.
It's not an easy life. You choose a life that's back to basics.
Yeah.
So
things are simplified and things can get blown off and you might not see them again. It's not like being blown off onto the lawn where you can go and get it. It goes in the tide and...
It goes out with the tide.
Yeah.
And
sometimes a few days later or weeks later it comes back or you find it. Going up and down the creek, as I do a lot, going fishing and things.
And
going fishing, coming back at low tide, you know, it's amazing what you find. When the tide's right out and everything's exposed, you see, I wonder where that had gone. Or you find something new.
Right, wow, yes. And what about mosquitoes?
They're not so bad because it's salt water. Surrounding us.
Right.
And salt marsh. So far, we don't have salt marsh mosquitoes.
Okay.
With a bit of global warming, we may. And but up in the bush, of course, it's as bad as anywhere bushy on Waiheke.
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah.
So
they do come down on a still, humid night. You know, we get plagues and we just have to light coils or we have a net.
Mm-hmm.
Mozzie net.
Oh, okay, right.
It can be just as bad as anywhere.
Yeah, it would be. The fishing there would be quite good, wouldn't it? You get flounder and...
Yes.
Probably catch an eel off the side of the boat.
Out off the sea? In the sea?
Because I've got a really catchy flounder net, it doesn't like the mangrove roots.
Oh, okay.
And so I go outside the mangroves to set the net.
Right.
The actual, you know, the actual fish around the houseboats, mainly mud snapper, I forgot the name of them,
Perori.
And eels.
Perori.
Which you can't actually eat. They taste...
I like perori.
You can? Yeah. Oh, well, I've tasted it and I thought it was quite intense and
like
quite
perori.
Muddy flavouring.
There's a way of doing it. There's
it's one of my favourite fish, actually. And I quite like it for just marinating raw.
Oh, yes, we've heard that.
Okay.
Because the flesh holds together.
Oh, right.
It doesn't fall apart.
Yeah.
So that's what's difficult about it if you cook it. It's the holding, it seems to be held together by the cellulose sort of structure that makes it a bit unpalatable. It needs a good marinade.
Yes.
After a good marinade, it's quite delicious.
Okay. Yes. Well,
we catch mullet and an occasional snapper and kahawai during the winter usually, and other things like little dogfish, the odd mackerel.
Excellent.
It's quite a variety.
Yeah, it sounds like a great place to live.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's hope that you're allowed to stay there.
Yes.
And we encourage people to make a submission to the unitary plan before the 31st of May, 5 p.m, in support of the houseboats on Waiheke.
You can do it through
shapeauckland.co.nz.
Okay.
Online, right. You can find a form and...
Is that quite easy to follow for dummies like me?
Yeah, it's on the right-hand side.
I guess if you can get there.
It's always a challenge. The yes, that's right. It's half the chin.
Yeah.
Challenge.
Well, otherwise, you could go to the council office and
pick up a paper form.
Oh, there is.
Okay. Library.
Right.
Or the library.
And the library. Yeah. Right. Excellent.
And probably other places too, like information centre maybe.
Right. Okay.
I think something really important to mention, I know we're trying to wind up, but is that we're actually currently, you know, permitted activity, and we're allowed to be there, and we have been for the last 30 years. There's been some kind of permission from councils, and, you know, so actually this new unitary plan is a change of the status quo and what's actually, it's a change that's being made into the plan. In the current plan, we're allowed to be where we are right now. So actually... you know, we should be have continuation of that right.
That's a good point. I didn't realise you'd been there so long.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yes, it has.
A valid lifestyle choice.
Early 80s. I've only been there since 91.
Okay.
6 months before the Resource Management Act.
Okay. And I guess that one of the problems that highlighted the houseboat issue was quite a few years ago, and there was a guy who put his huge houseboat down at...
Gary Moulton.
That's the chap, yes. And they had devil of a job to get rid of him.
He was the cause of all boating bylaws from the Auckland Harbour Board in the beginning, right through to rules they have made about foreshore structures before there were no rules. Before Gary Moulton, there were no rules.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, this is it. It just takes one person to muck it up for everybody, doesn't it?
Yes.
Which is unfortunate. But, well, thank you very much for coming in, Mikey. And
Vera,
yes. And good luck with your campaign to stay where
you
are.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we really appreciate the community support.
Yes.
Great. Not a problem.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, a weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onioroa.